record that.
We can just record each other taking a bath and then lay them on top of each other, and then it sounds like we're bathing together.
That's good fun for everybody. I don't see why that's not entertainment.
The thing is, that you can use that.
That's, surely someone can make something out of that. That is a show right there.
Yeah.
Two grown men bathing, right? That's half of the
And talking jovially, convivially.
And convivially.
and then at points, if it ever gets awkward, just whistling quietly to yourself.
You just hear splashing and whistling. Splash, splash, splash.
I can't quite read that. There, you got it.
So, Webcomics Weekly, everybody in the house except for Chris and Brad.
Chris and Brad. Except for Scott and Brad.
Scott and Brad.
This is a severely curtailed version of Webcomics Weekly.
This is almost akin to the old podcast Chris and I used to do.
I know. It's bringing back some fond memories. This podcast does not have a theme song yet. I guess it has that. I guess that'll serve.
You know what we could do is like an a cappella barbershop quartet version of that.
Let's do a Benedictine monk version of it.
and then as we all trail out, you just hear Brad laugh, Bill.
Just explosive laughter.
Yeah, exactly. So I have one question that I think is interesting for our international listeners. Did you get
Yes.
this one about international currency exchange?
I thought that would be a good one to work through, but I didn't read it yet. Do you
now,
mind
should
if
we should we save that for all four of us? Since Brad, as a Minnesotan, is essentially an international man of the world. I mean, as all Minnesotans are.
I just assumed that he didn't have any particular citizenship. I just thought.
Wait a minute! Did I just say Minnesota? He's from Michigan, isn't he? It's badass.
Oh, badass Michigan.
Michigan.
Whoop. I just changed my S and my X there.
That's all right. I think that's the traditional Native American way to say it, anyway.
Michigan. That's Popeye speak.
It's also the guy that works on my car. So you're gonna drive this to Michigan? All right. That sounds good.
Hey.
That sounds fantastic.
I'll give you a good deal.
So, what do you want to talk about today, Chris? What do you want to do on the old Webcomics Weekly show?
Well, gosh, I don't know. Maybe let's save that one because I don't really have a lot of input on that one. My feeling is make everybody conform to the U.S. dollar or wherever you happen to be living. If you live in Canada, then make Americans conform to that dollar. I mean, why not?
And if your product is dependent on the metric system, then you are boned selling to the United States.
So sorry, because nobody will understand. Well, but how big is it, though? Centimeters.
It's what's that unit of measurement that the Bible used to measure the arc?
Like a cubit.
A cubit, yeah. It's like, well, this book is 2 cubits by 4 cubits.
Okay.
My book is
30 centimeters by 45 centimeters. Okay, look. I want to be able to fit this thing in my house, okay? I don't know what this novelty nonsense is, but
you just like confuse every American out there. Like, all right, so this book, weighs 2 grams. So like, wait a minute, I ain't paying 2 grams. What's the exchange rate on that? Oh, what's the dollar to gram ratio right now? I don't even know. I ain't paying. That's expensive.
My book is 0.003 kilocams.
Kilocams.
There's your Star Trek for today.
The new jinxlet is 6 kelvins. All right.
And you can determine the size from the temperature. If you know the material and the atmospheric pressure, then you will be able to.
If you know the burn rate, then you're good to go on that.
Yeah. So go English system of measurement. That's what I say. Other than that, I don't know what else we should talk about. Maybe we should just talk. Just have a good sit down.
Just chatty chat, chat, chat.
Yeah. Like, well, what's going on with you? Are you getting ready to unleash a new book?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, this is talking about, because I think you and I were talking about this before the show, is that, in general, I've gotten fairly confident with my book production and stuff, but it's worthwhile to share with people that I get nervous as heck right as I'm sending the print files off to the printer.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's something we all share, because as I was sharing that with you, you kind of had a similar feeling, because it's
No, I actually just burped. That's what that was.
You're like, I express no sympathy for you.
I'm very confident.
No, but it's interesting how, for our business, there are a few key moments where you're really committing a lot of resources.
That's true.
And book production or plush production, it's not like a T-shirt where you can do a run of a couple hundred things. Like, I always just get nervous as heck when I'm submitting files for a printer, or I'm sure the same thing was true when you pulled the trigger on doing plush.
Yeah.
When you have to do a product in X number volume, you're just sitting there thinking to yourself as you fall asleep that night, oh my God, am I going to be sitting on 5,000 units of a terrible, terrible product?
Right. Well, I did. I actually got kind of I forced myself to get over it because I'm normally a guy who will beat myself up over any mistake anywhere. But I could not allow myself to do that with my first book because there's an image in that book. It's the cover of the first Lulu book, and I just thought that would be fun art to put in there as an extra. Mm-hmm. But I ended up making all the grayscale too dark for it, and it looks really dark as printed in volume one. And when I first flipped through it and I first got to that page, I was going, oh God, what have I done? Why did I not take, you know, every grayscale should have been 10% max. Like, I should have never done it, just direct port over from the other file. But I came to terms with it, like, well, all right, whatever. I spent the money. What else am I going to do?
Yeah.
I can either feel miserable about it or I can feel good about it. But that said, I'm getting ready to submit Volume 2 to printers next week. And this time, because the way I did it before, I opened a pre-order so I could have the money to do it with. But the pre-order and all that process took so long, then I feel really bad because the early adopters, the first ones who were like, oh, new Star Slab book, that's what I want because I'm a good fan. They're the ones who ended up waiting the longest. So this time I'm just going to have to bite the bullet and pay for it out of pocket. And then as the delivery date nears, then I will open the quote-unquote pre-order. And then everybody won't have to wait as long. I guess at that point it's an order.
Right, right, right.
But I felt really bad for everybody who had to wait so long the first time. I didn't know how long it would take to turn it around.
Well, what are your thoughts in general about pre-orders? I mean, with something like a big investment, like a book, because, you know, it can get to be a huge investment. Sometimes, depending on the size of your run, it can be anywhere from two to, I know guys that have spent closer to 10 on a print run.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about the what are the formalities of pre-orders that you think need to be observed?
One of the things that I'm going to do differently this time is that we are going to, as the orders come in, and you probably do this, you being a good business person, as the orders come in, I'm going to fill out envelopes then and there and not wait for, well, when the books get there, then we'll just scramble and get all the envelopes filled out and the postage put on them and rush them to the post office. I want to be able to just cram books in and send them as soon as they show up. So yeah, I think there's a kind of a longish tail on ordering or pre-ordering books, and you have to remember that a lot of people are, and depending on how long it takes to print, they may be waiting 2-3 months to see the book. And while that's part of a pre-order, is that you're kind of banking on the generosity of the more diehard fan who's willing to put up the money and willing to wait a little longer to be one of the first to get it. At the same time, it's kind of easy to drop the ball and before you know it, you turn around and somebody hasn't, you know, they ordered it 3 months ago. Where is it?
Right.
And it really sucks to do that to your best reader. So you just have to be on top of it. And
the only book that I allowed myself to do a pre-order with was How to Make Webcomics, because I trust, and this is my own insecurities coming through, is that I trusted Image to get that book done right. And so I felt like, okay, I can be sure that this thing is going to come out and it's going to be fine. But whenever I'm doing my books, I and this is my own emotional hang-up, not even a business hang-up, is that I can't allow myself to offer pre-orders until I have the product in my hand and can tell that it's, like, quality. You know what I mean?
That makes sense. That makes sense because one of the things that I feel terrible about, and I think it's only happened to me once or twice with really a very small amount of money where I would open, I didn't have the money to do like a shirt, and I opened a pre-order for it, and I would say get 9 interested parties, but everybody else passed on it, and that's not enough money for me to even produce the shirt. So now I have to say, I'm sorry guys, it just didn't work out, and I'm going to return your money. And that's an awful thing to have to do, is refund at when you thought that, you know, a week into the pre-order, you're going, ah, yes, it's working. And then a week after that, you're like, okay, this is not going to happen. There isn't enough interest. And now you got to give the money back. And I think that's a really ugly transaction to have to make with somebody.
Right, right. But it's funny because, depending on the size of your business and the level that you've committed financially, it can be, especially with a first book, it's A, terrifying, and B, a huge sink of cash.
Yeah.
And I can totally understand why people do pre-orders on a book that may be 3 months from being available, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't even, I would rather just carry that debt for 3-4 months and then put a book up that then arrives and I hate it, and I can't in good conscience sell. And thus far that has never happened, and I'm type A enough where I wouldn't let it happen for the most part. But
yeah. Well, so here's something that maybe other cartoonists can consider doing. I did something with, I essentially had the Jinxlets on pre-order, the plush dolls. But I said, if you want, you can get a gift certificate, or an adoption certificate. And that got sent out right away because I was able to print that. Right. I didn't have to wait for these plushes to arrive. And that's kind of a sign of a promise that would not be broken. You know what I mean? Rather than, I got you $20 and I'm just going to, you'll get it in 4 months. Don't worry.
Right, right.
So I think that was a good idea, to send something on ahead or to offer something additional. Like maybe if you pre-order it, you'll get the artist edition instead of just a signature. Something additional to make them not feel like, well, hell, I could have just waited for when it arrived and then bought it then. I could have waited 3 months.
And did you find that, had you factored in the extra shipping for the first and second round of things that were going out?
Oh, yeah, I had. Okay. Well, luckily, in that case, it was just paper, too. So
right.
That was not
it's
a big
minimal,
deal.
Yeah, it's the minimal shipping, essentially, for the U.S. system.
Right.
Well, that makes sense. I hadn't even thought about that.
But then again, it is kind of a mess to have to essentially do twice the shipping you were going to do originally.
Right,
but,
right.
So, I don't know.
I mean,
it's tough.
The system that you had mentioned before in terms of printing everything out, getting it all ready, getting it all pre-stuffed, my one limiter on that is that the Indicia system, which is what I use, and for those that don't know, Indicia is sort of a print at business postal system where you basically say, all right, this is a 2-pound package. What's that going to cost me to ship to Canada? And it prints out your mailing label and your stamp and debits it from your existing kind of postal account. But anyway, Indicia doesn't necessarily let you, I mean, you can pick a date in the future, but like if the book hasn't arrived yet, I'm always apprehensive to even do that, you know?
Well, help me to understand that. I know you can date the stamp, but let's say that, let's say I date the stamp today and then I don't get around to going to the post office and then Monday I've got to go. Are they going to look at that date and say, no, we can't ship this. It's dated Friday.
From what I understand, yes, it's supposed to be dated on the day that it's posted. So that if you date, I think, I'm more than willing to be correct.
Uh-oh. Did I lose you?
Then it has to go out Thursday, June 5th. And if you don't do that day, there's a thing on Indicia that has to do a postal correct or a date correct on it.
Ugh.
So, as far as I know, and like I say, I'm totally willing to be corrected on U.S. postal law, but I think that's how it works.
Well, maybe what I'll have to do is just fill out the envelope and not do the stamp until the book actually arrives. And I'm actually shipping it. But I mean, I can weigh another book because I figure the two books will be very similar in weight.
Right.
I'm not worried about that. But yeah. That is tricky.
It is tricky. The U.S. Postal Service is particularly arcane in some of its rules. And I think we talk about that in the book, that it's essentially we recommend starting off with the kind of small, minimal postal system, because you kind of have to learn as you go.
Yeah.
Like, there's, especially with international stuff, there's some weird rules about sending to the military, whether it be overseas or in the U.S., sending to certain countries, some of which follow pretty standardized pricing.
And or you'll get a military address, and it doesn't even, you don't even know what country that is.
The APO and FPO address.
Yeah, it's just numbers. I don't know where this is going.
Well, the military maintains a whole second mail system, so it goes to the person and then gets routed to wherever they're stationed in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think their address, their home station or permanent mail station, and then it gets routed to wherever they're permanent or where they're stationed at the moment. So let's move along. I wanted to talk about a strip that you and I occasionally email each other about and go, just hot damn. Akewood.
Akewood is a great strip, and I have not read it in a couple days.
I have actually, because of my own parenting schedule, have not read it either in a couple of days. But you and I always sort of IM or email one another and go, hot damn, did you see this one or did you see that one? What do you find is the most why do you think that the formula works for Akewood? What does he do right?
I think that, and this is something I'm struggling with because I'm trying to come up with a cast for a new strip. And I'm having great difficulty, and I'm trying to look to Akewood as an example, but it's really hard. I think the thing he does right is that all the characters are very strongly voiced. So, when I read it, I end up going, oh, Ray is going to do this. Like, I know how he's going to react to that. And because I've got that in my head, if he does it, then I feel vindicated. And if he goes opposite somehow, then I'm surprised and intrigued. You know what I mean?
Right, right. There's such layers to the characters, yeah.
And they're just kind of thrown together. And he's playing with pairings, and like, we'll see what these two do together when they have to get in a car and ride for 3 days, you know? And
right.
that's fun, and that's really interesting. And all the characters are I mean, the fact that they're so strongly characterized, he has blogs for all of them, right? He writes blogs for each of them.
As a creator, he definitely knows the voices for his characters. I mean, he's got it worked out with like 9 different feeds, 10 different feeds last time I checked for different blog entries, yeah. But you and I talked about this one time when we were, I think, driving or something. We talked about my wife's theory about the different levels of humor. Didn't we talk about this once? There's the first tier joke, the second tier joke, and the third tier joke.
Oh, we did. I don't remember if that was on a podcast or not. Let's assume that it wasn't.
Let's assume that it wasn't. So my wife's theory on humor is that there are first tier jokes, second tier jokes, third tier jokes. First tier joke is sort of the more obvious, broader, for lack of a better phrase, simpler joke. And I'm trying to think of a sample of what that would be.
Something in the newspaper.
Yeah,
accessible.
And I was telling you that I consider my own writing to be mainly first tier, and then I think your writing is stronger because it's second tier writing, which is, okay, I'm going to assume that my reader already knows that that joke is a possibility. So what I'm going to do is I'm either going to go opposite or I'm going to play with the fact that they were assuming, that they were making that assumption. So basically you assume a level of intelligence for your reader with a second tier joke. And I think what makes Akewood work so well is that he almost goes third tier, which most of the time people mess up on, which is sort of a meta humor, which is a joke on a joke on a joke, but you don't explain the first two iterations. So all you get to is that third iteration of the joke, you know?
Yeah.
You almost have to assume that there were two other, three other jokes that he went through to get to that one, but you only see the final result. It's hard to explain. We explained it much better in that last conversation we had. Well, how did we phrase it? Maybe you take it for a minute.
I'm trying to think of how it would work. I mean, I know there's a trade-off, which Akewood has kind of avoided, although maybe it hasn't because I know people who don't like it. There's a trade-off when you go from the first tier, the easier joke, or at least the broader joke, because those can be very hard to write, and I'm actually not good at it. When you go to the second tier joke and make the assumption that everybody understands what's going on, then you lose people who didn't know what was going on. And I, the place where I am with Starslip, I find it hard to keep everything first tier because there's so much going on right now that I, especially when I get deep into a storyline, I can't really back out and do all these expository scenes and slow the entire thing down. So I don't know that it's stronger. That's a word that you used.
Yeah, maybe stronger is not the right word. But you know what? Maybe a better way to say it is that he's more of a writer's writer.
Oh, I'll tell you something that he does do that might be considered third tier. He there's a lot of room in Akewood for him to play with I don't want to say observational humor because that sounds so weak.
No, but I know where you're going. It's like the fine details of life that most strips would avoid. But he, like, you know, it would be some random comment about Japanese floral arrangement or something, and that'll be the focus of the strip.
Yeah, and that really resonates. The one I'm remembering is that I don't remember where I read it, but like somebody said that it's important in the joke has to be funny or has to let the person get it and let it paint a picture in his head.
Right.
And to not use the obvious word and just assume everybody's on the same page, which is the second tier, absolutely. But the one I'm thinking of was Ray is wearing a fedora. And he says, "What do you think about this? This is awesome." And Roast Beef says, "No, it looks like you're what was it? It looks like you drive a Goldwing and collect samurai swords." And the place you have to go in your head to know what is a Goldwing? Oh, it's one of those motorcycles that has all those bulky pouches and stuff on the back,
right,
which is something that a dork would consider, like, that's my ride. That's awesome. It's a motorcycle, but it's still got room for my dice, you know.
But it has four separate shocks on every wheel. You know, it's one of those kind of bikes, yeah.
Right. It's a motorcycle, but it has space for snacks and a fridge.
It also fits the old lady who also was 55 on the back. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, but the fact that you know, he doesn't go all the way and be like, and say it's a motorcycle, which, you know, it is, and maybe some people would require that to get it. But the fact that now my head is filled with this guy who wears the fedora and he probably has a neck beard and, you know, he's a filker and he writes his own Linux kernel implementations, and it's just like, that's the guy. I understand. And that's much funnier to me than if he just said, "You look like a nerd," you know.
Right, right.
So he's really good at pulling those references in. That's not even the strongest one of his. He has much better ones than that one.
No, you're right. It's that there's a way to describe that type of humor, and I can't remember, but it's basically, I suppose, in the broadest sense, it's humor by association, where you're not clamming somebody over the head with a hammer. It's like these fine details that it's sort of a tapestry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like in terms of the writing,
here's one from a couple back. Ray and I don't remember this character's name. He's the guy who wears the is it Theodore? He's wearing the turtleneck with a T on it. They're at the bar and they're talking about the pizza parlor that they went to as kids, and then one of them says, "Blue cheese, ranch, Russian, French, Thousand Island," and then Ray goes, "Italian comes on the side because you gotta shake it," and they high five each other, like they remember, right? Yes, and like we've all had that dumb memory of whatever, and it's just perfect. It's encapsulated there. Can you hear Oxford barking?
I can.
He's upset about his reflection.
But it's interesting. It's always interesting to me on where people fall out on strips like Akewood, because you know we have cartoonists that we both love and respect that don't like it, and you and I always seem to resonate with it. It actually always surprises people that I like Akewood because it's a totally different style of writing than what I do.
Yeah.
But I actually revel in it. I think it's one of those strips that I wish I could do.
No, I know how you... I almost feel like, oh, but I can. Like, it's within my reach. I could do that strip. But then I sit down and try to do it, and it's always forced. It doesn't... It's not natural. It's always, I'm trying to make Akewood, and that doesn't work.
Right.
So I give up.
What's worth talking about, though, with his strip is that, because it's interesting from a visual style, is that it's like like Dilbert, the minimalism, I think, sort of adds to the potency of the writing after a while. Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, that's the best part, is that he's able to, at some point, and then that brings it back to the second tier, third tier thing, he's able to do more with less because you're already there. You know these characters. And you're uncomfortable when they're uncomfortable, or you know that this situation he's not going to like and this other guy is going to like.
Right,
and
right.
You don't have to have it laid out for you.
But the one fault that minimalism, this is where I was going with that, is that it works really well once you're in it, and the characters as a world work really well once you're in it. But I find it, or I found it when I first started reading it, I don't even know how many years back, is that it's very hard to get into it first. You know, there's the gate of entry is pretty high in terms of because so much of it depends on the weight of the characters themselves. And it's interesting to look at that, because I often wonder how hard mine or yours or anyone else's strip is. And it's worth, as cartoonists, to think about that, is how hard is it for the new person that's just clicking in today to dive into Starslip or to dive into Sheldon or PvP or Akewood or Goats or Diesel Sweeties? You
well,
know?
See, that's where Sheldon will win, because I think it's much easier to approach Sheldon. You know, like today's is just about, you know, Texans putting queso on everything. Like, who's going to read that and go, I don't understand. Like, what is a Texan, you know? But in my strip, it's, you need to read six strips back to understand that this guy's pissed off about this and he's going over here. And so I think it's a lot more, what you gain in being able to connect with the reader more deeply, you lose in the viral potential of a strip.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
if some Texas, like proud Texans live journal community, would pass that strip around, my strip is not going to get passed around by disgruntled curators who are drunks also, and like soft animals. Like what? No, they don't. That group doesn't exist.
Yeah, but isn't it funny though? As how as creators, when you're doing a strip, you've been doing Starslip now for three. Mm-hmm. years, right? And
yeah.
I've been doing Sheldon now for I don't know how many years, and Scott's been doing PvP for 10 years. It's funny how after a while, and I'd love to hear your comment on this, I find myself becoming envious of styles that I don't write. Like, I love and choose to write Sheldon that way because I like going for – I like being able to dive into different commentary that has nothing to do with the strip, like Texas, which is, you know – But it's also kind of low hanging fruit from a writing standpoint, but it's what I would consider to be shallow writing. I'm not creating some massive Bible for Arthur that you need to know that he was abused when he was nine.
No,
and that he went to boarding school, and I mean it's a
oh my
pretty...
God, Dave, he was. That changes how I read the strip now.
Oh. No, but you know what I'm saying though is that I become as creators. Don't you find, and maybe this is only me, I love writing Sheldon, so I want to start with that. I love writing that style, and I love writing Sheldon that way. But don't you find that after a while you start becoming envious of the strip that your strip is not?
Absolutely.
Like, because... I find I'm envious of Rosenberg for writing Goats into this long, like, gorgeous, thought-out storyline, or Akewood with all these in-depth characters, or,
I
you know...
think those strips, I think, they become ideal because they enable the writer to do both. You're probably envious of being able to tell a really long, engaging story that I can do. I'm envious of your strip because I can't. Every once in a while, Sheldon and Arthur will enter this meta construct space where the Texan appears, and then they talk to him for a week, and then you move on. I cannot drop that into my strip because there's no space for it to do that. It's not allowed to do that.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Or
yeah.
You had the embodiment of Wikipedia show up and had fun with that. But I can't. I have to find some end-around logical, like maybe in the future there's an equivalent of Wikipedia and I call it similar to Wikipedia so everybody understands the commentary I'm making. And I have to find a way to fit it. And that's really clunky. So
right.
I just don't
right.
do it. But yeah,
But
but then you've got like Goats and Akewood where, yeah, there's long stories and the characters are really strong. But then he's also allowed, they're both allowed to ditch out and just tell a dumb joke or an observation and then go back to what they were doing.
On some level, but I think no matter what style we've chosen, there's an envy to somebody else's style. Like Lynn Johnson could never just ditch out on it and go, I'm doing a Far Side today. Here we go.
Right.
Here's what I've always thought about Milkman. You know, like once you've committed and especially once your readership starts becoming attached to the direction that you've committed to, you're in some respects stuck there, you know? I mean, and I don't want to say permanently stuck. You can always slowly change it, but...
That's true, but I think it's harder to go... I think it's harder to go from Starslip to Sheldon than it is to go from Sheldon to Starslip. I always thought that I would like to see in your strip to have some longer stuff. I would like to see him... dealing with some business crisis, and that's why I know you did it before, and you don't do it as often now. Or I would like to see Sheldon when his parents were still around. You know, if he was of a suitable age back then, maybe he was a baby, or stuff like that, and add to the mythology of the strip. And you have the room to do that if you want to. It might turn some people off because they want to gag about, you know, somebody riding on the back of a pug or whatever, but they'll deal with it. Whereas Starslip, I don't know if I could back away from what's happening with the war and what's happening to Vanderbeam and all that. And because this week you've just gone off and you're riffing on, you know, coffee cup lids and what happened to the story. I don't know if I can back out there. I don't know if I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think if you and I sat down, we could probably solve whatever problems the other one was having. Like, my thought with that is that I think you have a construct of that this is a society driven by culture. You know, the political system is a culturally driven one, not a political or religiously driven one. And I think that is ready made for doing jokes that almost break a fourth wall. If you had a character or a construct, and maybe it's A to Z is the construct where you can almost do completely out of the Starslip timeline humor, you know?
Well, now that you said that, I just thought, well, I haven't really done a lot with, they could visit a society that's built on some ridiculous facet of today's society.
Right. And then I can play with that. Became a crew member, say, you know, like Star Trek did that when the Bajoran, after a good storyline, the Bajoran became a crew member, and then eventually became a whole storyline on Deep Space Nine. But you know, you can take an element of storytelling on Starslip and make that embodied in a crew member. Somebody who makes random jokes or who makes.
And Star Trek had to design a device for that, and that was the holodeck. We're sick of space. Let's have a medieval adventure.
Well, because I think the writers on Star Trek, and maybe it's funny how both of us are finding more energy in talking about it through a Star Trek metaphor, but I think the writers figured out that it's so lame when we go to a planet that's the planet of the Nazis. Okay, this is ridiculous, you know, from the original series. Why don't we make, because we know we want to be able to duck out and do that kind of sci-fi storytelling, but it's ridiculous if we do it like a new planet every week that has an Earth metaphor. So let's have an actual physical space that can recreate weird storylines. And I thought that was a brilliant way to
it was smart because they kept going to planets where, like, no, we need to explore this aspect of Earth society. So we're going to say that this planet just happens to be much like that aspect.
Right. But I find but that's an interesting aspect from both of us as creators looking at the other one going, I mean, you're looking at me saying, well, you have no limit on the amount of background you could tell to Sheldon or diving him back into the business aspect or with his family. And I'm looking at you saying, well, there's no problem with you diving into non sequiturs and random humor.
It takes somebody outside to see.
Yeah, it's funny how as a writer, if you're with your own writing style too quickly, or not too quickly, but too often, you get not in a rut, but you get comfortable with the way you've constructed your world.
Yeah, it gets kind of myopic.
Yeah, myopic is a great way to look at it. look at it. But all right, so maybe that's our challenge to each other. You make Starslip have a non sequitur ability, and I make Sheldon dive into more character building and long storyline. Because whenever I, what would you consider to be a long storyline? I consider a long storyline to be months long. Like I've done a week or two or 3 weeks long, but I don't consider that to be a long, long storyline.
It's pretty long. Anything that's gonna, you know, Sheldon always comes back to the status quo, even if you do a 3 week long story, which is good. But it would be neat to have some dynamic change. You know what I mean? Where,
right.
like Sheldon Suff gets bought out, and then now he's got to deal with a boss, and he's never had to deal with a boss before, you know? And if, maybe that one's no fun, but...
No, but in the background, you hear me just scribbling furiously, okay, boss, bought out.
Right.
Next week's storyline, good, good.
That requires a new character to be added, and then that kind of disturbs the balance. But Sheldon has the luxury of being able to... exit from that and not fixate on, oh no, how am I going to get my company back? Like for like a half a year, he could just go, I guess this is how it's going to work for now. And then you can have a big showdown and get it back later.
Right.
He can always have fun in the pond and at home and not have to deal 100% of the time with this impending disaster. But I feel Starslip is very much like I've lost the ability to go off and have fun. Because this war, what's going to happen with that? Because that's such a big deal. So I actually have a kind of a big plot twist that will show up next week, which I thought of last week, which will enable me to play a little more like that. So maybe we'll see about how that works.
All right, then. That's good. And here's something that I think we all suffer from. Or not all, but this is why I'm so glad that there are talented cartoonists like Meredith Grant and Danielle, and because I think we all suffer from a lack of good female characters and mm-hmm. just in general writing for the female voice. And I think that's true with a lot of people.
Absolutely.
You might take offense at that, but I think you and I both suffer from that.
No, I think that's true. I had to kill my primary female character to make her valuable. You know, she was more useful as a confessor figure for Vanderbeam than she was as a character. So, did I lose you?
No, but I like how we both went silent at our own fault.
We were just thinking about it. We're all moved by it.
We're both like, oh, we failed as human beings.
Well, I think the first good female character I've written was Holiday, where I actually am not trying to write, she's a girl. And I think that was the key to not write it like, she's a woman and she's womanly and she's got... But she's not so... she's not entirely womanly. She's not so feminine, but women and breasts, women and feminine, female... And like that, if that's your approach, then you are already going to write it wrong.
Right. You've already failed before.
She either has to play two type or totally against type. And that's the biggest problem. Like,
that's
she's a gamer.
Way to go. Yeah, exactly.
Come on. But you're right. It's not good.
And that's an admitted fault of mine with Sheldon is that I don't have, because it's that can be such a great, both for storyline and character development, is that interplay between male and female. And
he needs a little red-haired girl.
And that was so, you know, and it took Charles Schultz even 20, 30 years before he really started writing female characters good. You know, Peppermint Patty didn't come around until, what, the 70s?
Yeah.
And I thought that was such an intriguing character. And even Lucy got more and more of a storyline later on. But did Susie in Watterson ever get much of an individual storyline? At one point, she found Hobbs, right? But she never really got...
Yeah, we played with her a little bit, and we got to see her a little bit.
And we got to see elements of Calvin's mom.
Right.
But to be fair, no more than we saw of Calvin's dad on a one-on-one level.
Right. And they were through Calvin's eyes, so his mom was always the... You know,
but I guess where I'm going though is that most of American comic strip tradition has been pretty male centered. It's pretty bad in that respect.
Well, I had a every once in a while this topic comes up, and I think it's interesting. It might even be enough for a half hour's worth of stuff, but I'll bring it up anyway. The idea that it's harder for women to be funny, because when a man is funny, it's all slapstick. It's almost like that's the playing field, and that's where you take it at the face value, so it's fine. But when a woman is funny, there's an additional level of sexuality that kind of unsettles and almost spoils the humor part. You know what I mean? Like the example I had was, if a guy drops his pants, if his pants fall down for some reason, then it's just funny. Ah, that's silly. But if a girl drops her pants for the same reason, like her belt was cut or whatever, there's this element of, oh, wait a minute, I get to look at some legs now. And that wrecks what the joke was. So I think that it's harder to build humor with a female character because of that, because the male-centric audience is going, oh, maybe I'm going to get to see, you know, and that wrecks it.
Yeah, well, you're right. This is going to be, if we go down this path, this becomes a half-an-hour conversation. But you're right, because essentially, because A, there's a history of a lack of women in comedy, mostly because it's been men comedians, both as writers and as performers.
Mm-hmm.
A woman comes to represent womanhood on some level. Do you know what I mean? In the same way that, say, a black character comes to represent everything that in the white mind it represents, you know, African American or blackness or that, however you want to term it.
Right. Now there's a lens.
And so but it carries so much additional weight that it ruins the fact that this is an individuated character that has his own likes or dislikes, or has her own likes or dislikes, and is unique and is individual, because it's had all this external weight put upon it, that it makes it harder to write for that character, when in and of itself it doesn't have to be, but because there's this history of both a patriarchal system outside of it, and because there are less representations of women or minorities in comics, that you're fighting against that. So so without coming across like I'm writing my PhD thesis, I agree with you.
It is a deep
because it can get very deep very quickly in terms of like the trickiness of writing for that. But I'm recognizing my own fault in that I've essentially sidestepped it out of just I don't want to have to tackle that. But
don't you think it would be interesting to have women on the podcast and discuss that aspect?
Yes, we should have Meredith and Danielle both on and have them talk about it, because
we're qualified to discuss it.
And what they've done is they've created whole unique, wonderful characters that, and because they don't view it maybe with a, I don't know, what's the best way to say it?
Well, there's no, well, they are that. There's no, they don't have to go to some place to write it. And it may just be simpler to write male characters anyway. You know what I mean?
You know what it might be is that we're, and not to put too fine a point on it, but we're both sensitive guys who are trying to be nice about it, and in overthinking it, we're making ourselves too nervous to even write for it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, like, she you wouldn't write that. Don't write that. That's ridiculous.
Oh, don't. No one would say that. But my wife is always – my wife, who's one of the best writers I know, is always coming down on me for having such a total lack of – I don't know how you say it, female energy in the strip. And she's got a good point. I mean, the strip is what it is, but I think it would be a better and more interesting strip if it did have that.
She is good at writing, though, from there are very few women who I find genuinely funny for that reason. And I think it's because it's the same thing I said earlier. It's that if you, because there's this lens that you are forced, that society has constructed, that you have to look at a woman's comedy through, she then the response is, or the lazy responses are, to either play with type and go all the way that way, or play so far against type. So you end up with stand-up comics who are women who are they're either really vulgar, because you would never expect a woman to say that, or doing this housewife, sort of the domestic goddess type of stand-up, and neither of them I find funny. But there are very few who can write it. I think a really good example of it, too, is Tina Fey's character on 30 Rock.
Ah, so good.
She's not, like, there is, at no point is there, like, she's attractive, but she's not like the girl who you know, in the movies, like, what's that movie called? She's All That, where it's like, she's a nerd. And then, like, no, she's not. They put her hair in a ponytail and she's wearing glasses. She's like the most glamorous looking woman. And but she's really a dork and nobody likes her. That is crap. But I think 30 Rock is so well done from that angle because she is really a kind of a desperate person.
Well, as a
writer, not glamorized, which is awesome.
Tina Fey though is amazingly talented. She's so, and that's the thing is that the argument that holds no water for me is when guys start to argue that women themselves aren't funny. Women are hilariously funny. There's some of the best comedians gone. I mean, you can't tell me Carol Burnett or Lucille Ball weren't two of the most fantastically talented comedians that have ever lived.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's not that. I think the problem is a lot of externalities separate from the talent of the individual.
Well, that's the problem because then you end up walking away from it with the wrong view of it. Like in the example where the woman's pants fall down, you know, you can't do that joke easily anyway because you leave it going, "Well, that was kind of weird. I kind of felt, you know, I saw a little bit more than I." And it's like, "No, that wasn't the point of that." But that's all you took away from it.
And yet, though, Carol Burnett and Lucille Ball were both able to do what I would consider to be high and low comedy. I mean, they essentially did slapstick. I mean, I see where you're going as far as the quiet sexual energy that you have to avoid. But for the most part, they played that hand pretty well in terms of being able to do slapstick without getting that falling into that trap.
Who
you know?
Am I thinking of these comedians from the 50s? One of them was Martha Ray. The other one was Imogene what? Coca.
Oh, yeah, I know who you're talking about. Imogene, what was it? Copa?
Coca, yeah. They both had this kind of a, they played with the fact that they are not glamorous looking.
Right. And well, that, Roseanne played that very well too.
Yes. You know? Well, she did. That is true. And I think that's what made it work. Because there's no discomfort.
But none of this excuses why you and I are failing so miserably at writing a female voice into our scripts.
Well, I think I'm doing pretty good, Dave. So
it's also, you know, let's not overlook this fact. Most comics are written by dudes that did not smooch much in high school.
That is a big problem.
And that I think is without putting too much of gender studies problems onto it.
No, yes, absolutely. And I think that's probably the source of most of the problems with male cartoonists writing female characters because they actually lack that understanding. Oh my goodness. Dave, did I lose you?
Yeah, we lost each other.
How did that happen? I was still recording. I had a good example there.
Oh shit, I had a great point that I was making.
Oh shoot.
Well, anyway, I'll go back to it. I'm essentially saying that that's our fault as artists, is that it's not our lack of understanding of women or our lack of empathy with women. It's our own fear as artists to write that voice, I think.
I think it would be funny if we both had this two separate excellent points, and since we assume the other person isn't talking because they're listening, we just went on, and we were just in the zone, and we were philosophizing. We were coming to a deeper understanding and figuring it all out.
We had found the richness of the human experience, and we were expressing it in simple language that everyone could understand. And we thought a little tear was rolling down our cheek.
And that's what and that's really what I believe. Oh man, the screensaver! All right, damn it, I lost it. Well, I mean, if you want to make your point, you can because my point is recorded. I won't bother to repeat it.
That was essentially my point is that you and I do not suffer from a lack of social interaction or understanding, and it's our own fault as artists that we're not writing better female characters.
Oh, I'm all about the ladies, Dave. don't make any mistake. That's not the source of my problem.
Oh, let me tell you, my wife mentions far too frequently what a quote unquote wonderful man Chris Straub is. So I know where I stand on that front.
You should listen to her.
But it is an interesting, you know, an alternate viewpoint to look at, and maybe this is changing as we speak and with web comics. But do you think there's something to the medium of comics as mixture of text and image? That draws guys more than it draws women. I mean, manga has certainly changed that for young girls, and I know my nieces have gone nuts for manga and are drawing that all the time.
I think that's changing. But I do think that, I mean, originally, what were comics, you know, aside
Yeah,
from the.
was it the content that was originally
It was
making it?
male, and like aside from the handful of kind of go nowhere young romance, you know, from DC in 1953,
Right,
I don't
right.
know
Or the woman
anybody
who
who ever
punched
read
the
that.
American. Yeah,
It was
yeah.
mostly guys punching Nazis, so that's why
It's
women,
pathetic.
that's why it was a male art form, and then as you get of the age that where you're interested in drawing your own. Then, you know, that's a whole other topic because that ends up going into, well, why are women like, you know, a minority and why are, you know, would the minority be considered a minority in the field and blah, blah, blah. So, but I think it is changing. And I definitely think that companies now are going after that demographic
Right.
where they recognize that manga is accessible and so they go after girls now.
There is something culturally interesting that it took basically Japanese artists to get a generation of English-speaking girls into comics. That there's essentially nothing on the market. I mean, you know, that also you could make the same argument for getting children into comics with superhero stuff. Is that essentially they've raised the bar so much in terms of minimum age that there's whole generations being lost in superhero comics on some
Well,
level, you know.
there's something to be said about, and it also goes beyond gender lines. It goes to age lines. There's something to be said about comics being written by a guy who's 40 years older than you, and so that is on the page. There, we had Free Comic Book Day. When was that? Early May? Early this month? And I picked up a book, and I don't remember the name of it. Or I won't say the name of it to spare the person who did it, but it was an independent book. This guy was probably, from the way he drew, I would imagine he was a comic book artist from the 60s. He probably did work for DC or Marvel, and now that we're in the 2000s, he's got his own creator-owned property, and it's a superhero book. And he's trying to make it engaging. And it's very much like, if you want butt-kicking action, then this is the place, Jack. And it's this really antiquated, like, no, that doesn't fly anymore. That does not engage me. That doesn't interest me. And the entire book is written like that. And it's this vaguely racist, vaguely afraid of the modern age book. And it's really was kind of hard to read and kind of offensive. But I know that
I
it
would
was.
love it if you're like, and the title, Spider-Man.
It's Spider-Man. Yes, I stopped myself from actually making an example joke there. But yeah, but that book was really hard to read, and it reads like it was written by an out of touch old man. And the reason why I bring it up is that that's why you didn't see a lot. I don't think you saw a lot of that, like comics for girls or anything like that in the past, because it would be some, you know, 40-year-old guy going, "All right, what are the chicks like? I don't know. What is my daughter like? She's always going on and on about that stupid doll."
She's always talking. What is she saying? I don't know.
Right. So
I mean, talk.
that guy clearly can't write for that audience.
But that's why, you know, and for some reason, like Kathy doesn't do it for me, or for better or for worse, doesn't do it for me. But when I read Girls with Slingshots or when I read Octopus Pie, I realize how much I'm lacking. You know, it's weird. I think because they're written in a voice that I should be writing on some level anyway. You know.
Yeah.
Whereas Lynn Johnson feels like a voice, and Kathy feels like a voice that's 20 or 30 years older than me. But I'm so thankful that those strips exist because I almost think that when I start and the, you know, my long promised second strip, that's going to be a little bit kind of an older voice, that I have much to learn from Danielle and Meredith about writing a balanced strip. They do a wonderful job. And silence from you, nothing.
They do, Dave, they do. Are you making headway on a second strip? Or is it as stalled as mine?
Yeah, no, yes, I have characters drawn up, and I have. It's hard though because you know we've. I don't know if we've talked about this on the show before, but you know the promise that you make to yourself about I'm going to do a second strip is such a big one in terms of time management. I mean, making Sheldon work as a business and as a strip takes up so much of my time that I literally cannot imagine how I'm going to do a second strip.
Yeah, I want to pick your brain, and I want to pick the brains of the other Half Pixel guys, because I think that Starslip can be doing way more than it is, and I need to figure out good ways to do that. And I wanted to talk.
You know what would make for a great show?
Mm.
And I'm serious about this because we did some of this in the book. I want to get a show where you three tell me what I'm doing wrong, or you three tell me how you would handle Sheldon.
And
the three of us tell the other one how they would handle Starslip.
That would be a great four shows. Let's do that.
You know what? On some terms it might be uncomfortable, but on some terms it might be eye-opening in terms of how we would change our character bibles.
If you want to be successful, you need to be uncomfortable. And I'm the worst person to say that because I don't want to hear any criticism. I'm awful at it. I've been very lucky to hear so little criticism that when I do get some, it hits me.
Right.
So I can't imagine a worse feeling than being criticized by my friends.
But I know that just continuing that thought about, like, I'm envious of other people's writing style because it's something I can't write for. I mean, just talking with you, I'm realizing, well, why couldn't I do a Goats-like storyline for a month or two? Or why couldn't I write, you know, not Akewood, but something that is second or third tier humor more than I do with Sheldon? Or why couldn't I do something as you do with Starslip that's different? You know, and there's no reason. Sometimes you just got to shake out what you're comfortable with after 3 or 4 years of writing something.
Yeah.
So, yes, let's do that. Bam. Let's hope we get the other two guys to, like, ain't no way I'm doing that. Not in public. I'll talk
or like
to you.
They come on and they do, all right, here's what's wrong with Sheldon. Here's what's wrong with Starslip. And then, all right, let's do the Evil Inc. show. Brad's not here.
Huh. Why does Scott keep calling in sick? This is amazing.
I don't know.
we're just crying at the end of our episodes, and they're like, well, all right, that was good. I needed that. All right, well, next week we're going to do PvP, right? Oh, no. No, I never agreed to that.
And it's like this new agey kind of, like, a primal scream therapy that we're trying to convince them to do, but then they don't want to. Like, God, guys, you know, it was really hard, but we got through it, and I feel so, so strong now, and it's so good, and you really have to do it. No, I'm good. I'm not a girl. I don't need to do that, the crying and the
you
stuff.
Know what? I am comfortable with where Evil Inc. is. I do not need to change anything. No, Brad, I think you need it. Nope, I'm good. I'm good.
Well, that's funny because I think maybe we saw just a hint of that, which was interesting on the other podcast where Scott brought up the blog PvP Makes Me Sad, and where it's not just a Scott sucks blog. It's actually like, here's what we like about PvP and here's what we didn't like this week.
Right.
And it's actually kind of useful criticism. But Brad couldn't get beyond the title. If there was a strip, Evil Inc. Makes Me Sad, he would just be like, no, don't be sad. It's supposed to bring you joy. I don't have anything. I'm not going to listen.
I do not want to take part in even knowing that this exists.
Whatever you have to say. Ooh.
Oh, there's your ride.
All right, I got to run.
Hey, Mom's here. Got to go. Thanks for hanging out at the mall with me.
We're going to Walmart.
Gotta get new pants.
Right.
That would actually, and if we were to do it in public, which I think is probably the best way to do it for the benefit of many, I think that we would actually probably end up learning from, like, here's what Brad, I think you're doing wrong. Like, I would learn from what Brad is, what changes we would recommend for Brad, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then we would learn all around, and then we would share that.
And then I think rainbows and sunshine.
I think that would be the best. And can I back it up a second and say, I don't know that this has ever been addressed, and I tried to get into it a little bit about what makes things funny and Akewood is really good at it, but the idea that, like, when the horn honks outside and it's time to do a riff on it, first level would be, not even first level, it's like 1.5 level, is your ride's here. That's a good quip. The
right.
Next level, which I didn't get right, would have been the second or third tier, would be now make it more specific. Like, you're going to grandma's picking you up. We're going to Walmart. I was gonna try and make it real nested, but the beat was wrong. I missed it. But I was gonna make a joke somehow about, like, she needs to get more of, you know, those loose beads for her arts and crafts projects, or like she needs to get more of those decals for her scrapbooking, like where you make it right. So specific that paints a picture. I don't know if that's always good and always a concrete piece of advice to offer, but I think that kind of stuff really punches up.
That's
bags.
Actually something you taught me, is that sometimes even unnecessary specificity makes it funnier just for the sheer specificity of it. Like, why did it have to be a Yosemite Park ranger? Why couldn't it have just been a ranger? You know, like, why did that become funnier because it was But I mean, I think you just explained it better than I was trying to say it before about why Akewood I consider to be a third-tier joke, because the way those levels play out is often just like you described it. It's the way a riff builds when two or three friends are talking. And I think I tend to go for the first one or two jokes. You tend to go for the one that's the second, third, or fourth iteration. And I often feel like Akewood is the one that you had to have been sitting in that room with your beer in your hand for 20 minutes while that riffing was building. And then that's the moment that he captured. And that's why I think it's so brilliant, is that he captures that moment 20 minutes in, you know?
Yeah.
When it's the joke upon the joke upon the joke that you really have to parse out, like, why is it a gold wing, and why does the guy have a fez, and why, you know, like,
right? Yeah, there's a prime example, and it's gonna betray my enjoyment of it, and I wish I could do more with it myself, but I can't. I don't know how many people actually read somethingawful.com, but they have a series of essays that come up from time to time, and it's all. They're fake entries from. They're supposed to be from IMDb, but they're fake entries. Mm-hmm. So it's all trivia and goofs from and casting from movies that don't exist. That humor is constructed around you imagining a movie being made that way. I'll give you an example. I'll read you an example. It's right here. This was an entry for Indiana Jones and the Vessel of Ra, which is clearly not a real movie. And here's from the trivia section, one of the things. Indiana Jones and the Vessel of Ra sets a record for the most usages of the word ort in a motion picture, 46. It soundly beat the previous record holder, Magic 8 Ball, from 1992, in which ort was uttered zero times. It's so thick. That, what was it? There was another one where it says such and such actor was actually sidelined for 5 weeks during production because he contracted hepatitis from eating an old man's tooth. And you have to go to that place in your head, like, what circumstance was he able to...
In what manner could that
Why
ever happen?
Why would that ever
but
happen?
You know what? That is the same. If you look at it, that's the same joke construction as The Onion, which is like you take a level of unnecessary detail, and IMDb has that, and very often the news has that, where, you know, like three paragraphs into a story, you're like, you know, Mr. Jones, who was tall, you know, paunchy and likes to breathe heavy, you know, that kind of stuff in journalism.
Yeah.
And you play on that and just fill it up with unnecessary detail. And there's totally a whole vein of humor that plays up that angle of unnecessary detail.
Yeah.
So that's the first time I've ever seen it with movies, though. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, I think it's excellent.
But that's what I think, and I don't know why I keep going back to Akewood, but culturally, that's what I think he does. You know, like, what The Onion does for news, and what those guys on Something Awful are doing with movies, he kind of does in terms of a broader cultural... Listen to me, I'm just patting him on the... I've never met the guy. I'm patting him on the back for 20 minutes. Everything you do is gold to me. You deserve that Time magazine article, champ.
I love you.
I love you so much. I would leave my wife for you.
No, you don't understand. My life is better. My life is worth living.
I find a wholeness because you exist. You have brought me peace of mind.
I could never tell him that. I could never tell him that. And then you actually run into him at a con, and it's everything you can do to not tongue kiss him.
That's just me with the sweatiest hands ever shaking his Anyway. Yes.
That is the way it works.
Well, my friend of old, it has been a pleasure chatting with you.
It has been. We actually did hit the hour mark on our own.
Did we?
Other guys are dead weight. Yeah,
And
we've been.
did we make anything substantive? Probably nothing. Probably nothing that helps anyone in their career or their creative process at all.
I think it's good. I mean,
I think that's good. I think
don't.
that's
Well, don't get me wrong. I think that having questions, people sending in questions, is integral. It's critical that that happens, and we get those questions and answer them. But occasionally, we'll have stretches where, we've kind of run over those questions already. You know what I mean?
Right, it's how do I build an audience and how do I make money and yeah.
Right. And there's only so many times we can answer that, so we should be able to go other places. I definitely like the idea of us critiquing each other's work and making that like a whole series.
Yeah,
I think there might be 45 minutes in everybody's trip from that.
if you know if you if you have sort of the moxie to say, well, why don't we give advice to the world? We should have the moxie to say, you know what, I deserve to be critiqued as much as anyone else. So
Absolutely.
yeah, I'm all for it. And now that we've publicly made this proclamation, let's see if we can get the other guys to do it. You know what's funny is like someone listening to this like 6 or 7 weeks on, and nothing ever comes of it. It's just us with all our high talk. The other guys are like, hell no, I ain't
the
doing
next podcast, you and I are very, very quiet, and
I'm glad it's
it's
got our
just
answer.
Scott and Brad running roughshod all over it, going, okay, how to build an audience? We get this question a lot, but I figure let's dive into it again.
It's just immediate. It's like not even the music. It's just immediately us diving into, all right, mailbag. And did you just hear you sighing?
Mailbag, Chris, do you want to read the question? Chris, do you want to read the question? Okay. How many comics do I need before I start my before I launch my website? Well, it's funny you should say that. I think that 30 is a good number, and
No, but you read the question, and they're all energy. It's just you kind of real quiet in the back. How do I turn a TIFF into a JPEG? All right, well, I can answer that for you. You quiet.
Yeah, Brad just rubbing his hands together. Oh, I love this one. Okay.
Ooh, me. All right, here we go. Here we go. So,
open Photoshop.
what do you want to do is you want to launch the GIMP, and then, anyway.
And
All right.
and here's the best part. He's like a model maker. Like he relishes just the detail, just the act of doing it. Sometimes I'll convert GIFs to JPEGs and then back again, just to see what pixels changed.
Can I get back to the original set of pixels? I often do that after 6 or 7 iterations.
Well, that sounds interesting to me. Anyway, Brad, what about your input? Brad, do you, Brad? Oh, I'm sorry. I was converting. I was busy.
I'm doing that right now.
Yeah. All right, my friend, we have done it. We've
We've
carried
met,
this podcast.
right? We've talked. We've solved gender and race issues, I think, poorly. I think
Right.
we've solved how to feel bad about your strip in public, about what you how you're failing at it. What else did we solve?
We solved kissing Chris Onstad's butt for like
Right.
40 minutes.
I've solved that one, so that's good.
Check that off
Check
the
that off.
list.
We've solved the problem with rising world food prices, and I think that's it for an average Webcomics Weekly. We are done. We're out. We're good.
Very good. Very good, Dave Kellett of SheldonComics.com.
Well, thank you, Chris Straub of evil-comics.com.
Oh.
And later, latterly of starslip.com.
Oh, you're
Wink to the
telling.
audience. Wink to the audience.
Wink. You all saw what I was doing.
First iteration.